So we are a couple of weeks, of course, into 2022. And I know that so many people have made resolutions. Some of you already broke them already, whether it's to put your health at the top of your to-do list or follow your passion. I know the mark of a new year is that we've been conditioned to reset and get all pumped up for our next chapter and all the possibility that awaits. But I want to propose something to you all today. I want to propose that you resolve something very powerful, to love who you are right now. And of course, I think that wanting to be your best self and setting goals and intentions is really major. But I remember during a stop on the 2020 Vision Tour, I met this reporter in Miami. We took some photos together and she said to me, "Oprah, next time you see me, I'm going to be so much skinnier." And I replied, "Well, the next time I see you, hopefully you're going to be as healthy as you can be in that moment. Because right now, this is as healthy as you can be in this moment. And the next time you'll be as healthy as you can be in that moment." I told her to be kind to herself. And she looked at me and said, "How do I do that?" Well, it starts with loving right now who you are, all yourself, your flaws. Living in a space of lack, focused on what you don't want or what you don't like about yourself, I promise you, I've learned it doesn't work. Take a moment to look at what is really running through your mind about yourself that may be holding you back. The energy of the universe responds to positivity. And so if you're telling yourself you're not slim enough, you're not good enough, when that negative chatter starts in your head, stops, lean away from it. When you let those thoughts of not being enough seep in, you can't really act out the best of yourself. So your actions must be in alignment with all the goodness and strength that you know to be true about yourself. So this week, I'm inviting you to put on your happy sweater, wherever it is or whatever that is for you. Quiet all the negative self-talk and allow your confidence, your sense of knowing that better days are ahead, to be at the forefront of your thinking. Tomorrow is never promised. So let's accept and then let's celebrate ourselves just where we are right now. Thank you. Thank you for where I am and who I am right now. Let that be the blessing and intention for ourselves this week.
You know, when I was a kid, I thought I was going to be a social worker or be a teacher or somehow be in an environment where I would be connected and speaking to people to honor that calling. I had no idea that God could dream this big dream of a television life for myself. But everybody has a calling, and your real job in life is to figure out as soon as possible what that is, who you were meant to be, and begin to honor that in the best way possible for yourself. We have seen over the years on The Oprah Show so many people who've been able to rise to success in their life and only able to rise to success because they answered the call. Lots of people think that it's about being famous or about being known or about doing big, big, incredible things. What you're going to hear today and see through the stories is that sometimes the calling is right in your own neighborhood. Sometimes the calling is something that was just a whisper to you. And when you begin to honor that whisper and to follow that, you end up being the best that you could be. So in my own life, I have to say that I had no idea that I would end up being who I have become, but I had a strong belief that the calling was something greater than what Mississippi was showing me. The calling was greater than my front yard. The calling was greater than what my grandmother believed that my life could be.
The problem is everybody is meeting hysteria with more hysteria. And then we just are all becoming hysterical. And it's getting worse. What I've learned all these years is that we're not supposed to match it or even get locked into resisting or pushing against it. We're supposed to see this moment in time for what it is. We're supposed to see through it and then transcend it. That is how you overcome hysteria. And that is how you overcome the sniping at one another, the trolling, the mean-spirited partisanship on both sides of the aisle, the divisiveness, the injustices, and the out-and-out hatred. You use it. use this moment to encourage you, to embolden you, and to literally push you into the rising of your life. And to borrow a phrase from my beloved mentor, Maya Angelou, just like moons and like suns, with the certainty of tides, just like the hope springing high, you will rise. Well, you know, I managed to get here. Stedman and I have absolutely differing philosophies, because he teaches the idea of, he has a book called You Can Make It Happen, 9 Steps to Success. And he's always talking to me about having a vision, that with no vision, the people perish. And I always say, I didn't have a vision. I didn't have a vision to get here, to where I am. My vision was surrendering to what I believe was God's vision for me. And I always say, God can dream a bigger dream for you than you can dream for yourself. I now believe that I need a vision. I think Stedman is finally right, that in order to continue to move forward, that I need to develop a vision for myself. And one of my big goals is to use this television show as a forum and a catalyst for change in people's lives. That's one of them. The other is to move out into the world in a more impactful global format to help women and children across the globe. Without education, the people perish. Without education, nobody will be able to survive. Without education, women cannot overcome poverty, will not be able to learn to take care of themselves, will not be able to move forward on the planet. So I want to use my life and this television show to continue to do that. I think some people think that, are under the impression that I was born empowered, that I was born coming out of the womb, ready to interview a Klansman. But the truth is, I know very well what it's like to be marginalized, to be told either subtly or quite directly that my contribution isn't or wasn't welcome, that my face was invisible, and that my needs were an affront. So back when I was doing the news in Baltimore, I asked to be paid the same as my co-anchor, who did exactly the same job as I was doing. And I expected that I would be compensated. So I went in and I asked that I would get the same amount of money. So he was doing the same job I was doing, except that he called me babe all the time. Babe, yeah, babe. Anyway, I was told by my news director and by the general manager, because first I went to the news director, then I went to general manager, and I was told that because I was a single woman who didn't have a mortgage and I didn't have kids, that I was not entitled to earn the same kind of money as the man who was sitting next to me doing the same thing. And I realized in that moment that my employers did not get it. They did not understand my value. But you know what? I did. So cut to AM Chicago. The team's hard at work, and they had been working for a long time. And after a year or so, we were asked to be syndicated. That work began to pay off. And before long, we were now no longer called AM Chicago. We're the National Oprah Winfrey Show. I got a raise, but my producers did not. So I went into the boss at the time, and I asked that my producers, who incidentally were all female, I asked that they would be given a pay raise increase. And my boss, this is in 1986, said, why? They're only girls. What do they need more money for? Girls. I've used the word affectionately sometimes, referring to women as girls. And there was no affection in his tone. It was absolutely condescending. So, you know, it takes a while to develop a voice. But once you have it, you damn sure better use it on stuff that matters. So I took a deep breath in that moment and said, either they're going to get raises or I'm going to sit down. I'm not going to work if they don't get paid more, babe. I would like to believe that I could have spoken that kind of truth to misogyny, even if I'd been all by myself. But here I was on the brink of finally getting what I really wanted and had been working many years for, a national show. I mean, I might have been too intimidated to stand my own ground against this guy if I were actually alone. But here's the thing, you're never alone. You're never alone. The sovereign sound of Maya Angelou's voice was pushing me forward that day, whispering, I come as one, but I stand as 10,000. So when I was faced with the opportunity to advocate for my producers, I silently called on some of the 10,000 and walked into my boss's office, hand in spirit, with the women who had come before me. I could feel Bessie Smith and Billie Holiday and Ella Fitzgerald and Pearl Bailey and Sarah Vaughan and Lena Horne clutching their green books looking for a place to eat while they sang in supper clubs for whites only. And I could feel Recy Taylor and Rosa Parks refusing to relinquish their dignity in the face of death threats. All these women were with me that day walking into the office in Chicago, as was Diana Carroll and Petula Clark and Joan Baez and Mary Tyler Moore and Moms Mabley and Barbara Walters and all of the astonishing women whose names none of us will ever even know, despite their sacrifice. And I'm pretty sure I even heard Shirley Chisholm urging me on with this thought: if they don't give you a seat at the table, bring a folding chair. I understood that there were so many times that many women from my mother's generation and God knows my grandmother's generation who were forced to grit their teeth and just take it because standing up for themselves wasn't even an option. The risk was too great and they knew it. But they also knew in their bones what my dear friend Maya put so eloquently into words when she says, you may not control all the events that happen to you, but you can decide not to be reduced by them. Because these women and so many others like them made the decision not to allow themselves to be reduced by the many injustices they were subjected to, I found the strength to act, if not just for myself, not just for my producers, but for all the women who, in their ingenious ways, subverted the rules, laid the foundation, and pushed the envelope just a little bit further for me. We all are here to fulfill the dreams of those who came before us. Maya used to say, you've been paid for. You've been paid for, young people, so put your crown on your head and wear it. We are here not merely to bear witness, but to be the new voices of an extraordinary new age. You see, when I was growing up, there were no black people in the media, just buckwheat, on television. And I was constantly doing that thing, looking to find myself. And what I found instead was Leave It to Beaver and Donna Reed and Lassie, although technically I guess Lassie was mostly brown. The point is, though, we are now able to see ourselves reflected through entertainment. But what pleases me most is that we're beginning to see on screen, what we're beginning to see is starting to change the landscape of what we see behind the scenes, what Kamal was talking about, true inclusion. And what I realized during all those years doing the Oprah show, and the reason that OWN is now thriving, is how essential it is to see yourself reflected in other people's stories. It's something that you, as white people, never have to even think about. Because the more you see a broader and richer and more nuanced depiction of yourself and your neighbor and the world, the more empowered you become. And it's that sense of empowerment that actually tethers us to the universe. It gives us at least a glimpse of how connected we all are. So what a blessed sign of progress it is to know that millions of kids in 2019 don't have to stand with their noses pressed up against the window or the television screens, looking in at a family that makes them feel less than by comparison. Today we can point to work that says you are every bit as valued and vital to the fabric of life as anyone else. You are a part of a community. But it takes time. It takes time to see yourself. It takes time to hear yourself and to feel appreciated for just being yourself. Empowerment does not happen overnight. Like change, it is never just one thing. It is a series of consistent steps great and small, that proves to us again and again that genuine change is actually possible. So many people are worried about building a brand. I hear kids on social media talking about their brand. And I used to really resent the word when people would say to me, oh, you have this brand, because I never even thought about a brand. I just thought about day in and day out, making the best right choice for me. But now I embrace it because I recognize people see me as a brand. But for me, it's not a business. It is a question of, what do you stand for? And I will say this, you're nothing if you're not the truth. And that's the, if I could leave you with any message today, that is it. The biggest reward is not financial benefits, though it's really good. You can get a lot of great shoes. Nothing wrong with great shoes. But those of you who have a lot of shoes know that having great shoes and a closet full of shoes or cars or houses or square footage doesn't fill up your life. It doesn't. But living a life of substance can. Substance through your service, your offering of your whole self. And the baseline for how do you live a life of substance is whatever is the truth for you. What do you stand for? People may not remember your every word. They may not remember all of your actions, but they certainly remember how your words and your actions made them feel. So let's leave here today with the collective memory of wanting to create enlightenment in the world. Let's leave here knowing that we can give people the sense that they have been heard and respected. Let's foster original thinking and humane treatment. Let's seek out the words we don't know. Let's do away with the us and them. I've seen us and them create a whole lot of problems, but I've never seen it solve one thing. Instead, let's nourish our artists. Let's offer the possibility of something better for all of us, because a new day is no longer on the horizon. The new day is now. One of the things I started to get around mid to late 90s is that everybody that I had on the show, at the end of the show, would say something to me like, was that okay? Was that okay? How was that? Was that okay?
Right.
At the end of the interview. And I started to then track it. It didn't matter if it was, I had gone and done a show where I was in a prison and I was interviewing a father who was in jail for life for murdering his twin daughters. And at the end of the interview, even behind bars, he said to me, is that okay? How'd I do? And Barack Obama said it when he sat in the chair the first time, and George Bush said it. This is what I learned sitting in that chair for 25 years, that at the end of the day, whether you are interviewing me or I get to interview you, whatever your profession is, wherever you are in your life, in your relationships, every person that you encounter, every experience, the person wants to know, was that okay? Was that okay? And what I started to hear was that what people are really saying is, did you hear me? Did you hear me? And did what I say mean anything to you? And so I started to listen with that in mind, with that intention of validating that you're being here, you're speaking to me, you're taking the time to do this with me is important because you matter. And that's true for everybody who's watching or listening, that every argument that you ever have, every encounter, the person just wants to know, did you hear me? Did you see me? And did I say anything that mattered?
Everybody works hard and everybody has their own dreams. There was a time where I used to spend a lot of energy wanting things. Of course, it's easy for me to say, oh, things don't define you because I got a lot of things. Things are nice. I like them. But this is what I learned. When you can surrender to the dream, you get to live in the space of the higher power. You get to live in the space that you purposefully have come to earth to claim for yourself. So around 1984, I was sitting in bed one morning. I was reading the New York Times review of The Color Purple. And I thought, whoa, this sounds like a really great book. I got out of bed in my pajamas, put on my galoshes, and went to the store to get the copy of The Color Purple. I read The Color Purple in one afternoon, went back to the bookstore, bought every book of The Color Purple. I took the books to the office, and I said to everybody, y'all got to read this book. Oh my God, you got to read this book, Color Purple. I needed a book club. I didn't have one. So I pass out the book to everybody I knew. Please, read The Color Purple. Read The Color Purple. Then I start to hear that somebody's going to do a movie about The Color Purple. But I don't know anybody in the movie business. By this time, I was on AM Chicago. I don't know anybody. I start praying to God. God, please help me find a way to get into Color Purple. I say, Jesus, I don't even have to have a speaking part. I will be, because I went to the movies and I saw on the movie credits, at the last credit, there's something called Best Boy. So I said, Jesus, if you just let me be Best Girl, that'd be all right by me. I can be Best Girl. I can carry the script. I can help the people with the water. I can do whatever. So I start praying for The Color Purple, as divine law would have it. Quincy Jones comes to Chicago, and he is in Chicago for one half of a day because somebody has filed a suit against Michael Jackson claiming that Billie Jean was their lover and that's not his song. So Quincy had taken the red eye to Chicago. He was in his hotel room. He was coming out of the shower, and the television in his hotel room is on AM Chicago. There sits little chubby me with my Jerry Curl on AM Chicago. Quincy Jones tells Reuben Cannon, the casting agent, I think I found Sophia. So I get a call from Reuben Cannon, who says, I'm calling about a movie. It's called Moonsong. Would you be interested to come and audition? And I say, I have not been praying for Moonsong. I had not been playing for Moonsong. I've been praying for The Color Purple. He said, well, I think you should come and audition. So I go to audition. You know, movie people, they make everything all secret. Steven Spielberg didn't want anybody to know he was doing Color Purple. So on the outside of the script, it says Moonsong. But I know all the words by heart. So when I open the script, I know this is The Color Purple, Jesus. This is The Color Purple. So I auditioned for The Color Purple. I can't even believe it. They don't just want me to be the water girl or the best girl. They are asking me, do I want a part in the movie? Oh, that I'm thinking prayer works. 3 months pass. 3 months is a long time. I auditioned in February, March, April, May comes. I haven't heard anything. So I call Reuben Cannon. I say, Mr. Cannon, I'm sorry, sir, I haven't heard anything. I expected to hear something by now. And Reuben Cannon, African-American man, says to me, you don't call me, I call you. And I didn't call you. Do you understand that I have real actresses who have auditioned for this part? Real actresses. And he tells me who just left his office. And I went, well, okay, I'm not getting that part. So I hang up the phone and I start crying. I can't believe that God has played this trick on me. I think, this is a trick. So I decide that this is because the fat has finally caught up with me. The fat has finally caught up with me, and now I must get rid of the fat. In 2 weeks, I am going to go to a fat farm, and I'm going to lose 25 pounds. I'm going to drink a lot of green juice. I'm going to have some cleanses and colonics. So I also was trying to make peace with it. I said, God, I don't understand. I thought it was for me. You ever had that talk with God? I thought it was for me. I thought it was for me. God, you let me audition with somebody named Harpo. That's my name backwards. Jesus, that was a sign. Wasn't it a sign? And then 3 months pass, and then Reuben Cannon says, real actresses have just left his office. So I start to pray on the track. I'm out on the track at the fat farm, and I am running around at the track at the fat farm. It starts to rain. Y'all know how that is. But I don't even care, because I am praying to God to help me to let it go. Help me let it go, because now I've become obsessed with it and it's now controlling my life. I start praying, running around the track, and I keep hearing this noise, and I can't, there's nobody on the track but me, and I'm running around the track. And I look around and it is my thighs rubbing together. My thighs are rubbing together, causing this thunderous sound. There's nobody on the track. So then I really start to cry. Oh, Lord, help me. Help me let it go. Help me let it go. Help me let it go, God. Help me let it go. And you ever did this prayer where you say, okay, Lord, okay, I'm going to let it go. Then you get up and you go, well, I think I still got a little bit of it. I did. Help me let it go. But I am not going to be able to see the other actress in my part. I won't be able to see it. Won't be able to see Color Purple. Just can't never see it the rest of my life. I won't be able to see it. So then I started, I don't know where it came from. I surrender all. I surrender all. All to thee, my blessed Savior. I surrender all. I sang and I cried. I sang and I cried and I prayed some more until I could reach the point where not only will I be able to go to the movie, but I can bless the other actress. I can bless her. I can say, I bless you. I bless you. I bless you with this. I surrender all. I surrender all. All to thee, my blessed Savior. I surrender all. And I tell you, in my greatest testimony, that the instant I laid that thing down, I'm telling you, when I laid it down, when I laid it down and it didn't have me anymore, it had no control over me anymore, I didn't feel anything about it anymore, when I let it go, when I intentionally surrendered it to the power that was greater than I could ever know. The instant that happened, a woman comes running out of the cafeteria screaming, Ofri? Is your name Ofri? For 10 years, nobody could pronounce my name. I said, yes. Yeah. She said, somebody's on the telephone for you. He say, name Spielberg. I get to the phone. He says, I hear you're at a fat farm. I said, no, sir. This is a health retreat. He says, I'd like to see you in my office in California tomorrow. This was in Wisconsin. I'd like to see you in my office. And if you lose a pound, you could lose this part. No problem do I have. I'll have no problem not losing a pound. So, honey, I packed my bags and I stopped at the Dairy Queen. I got 3 scoops just in case I'd lost a half a pound. And the next day, I was in Steven Spielberg's office and he said, you're hired. You're hired.
You have no idea of the power of noticing another human being and what it feels like when somebody knows that they have been seen, truly seen by you. It is the greatest offering you can give. And all those years of the Oprah Show, the greatest lesson I learned was that, you know, after every show, someone would say invariably in one way or another, how was that? I'd finish an interview with a father who killed his twin daughters. I'd finish an interview with a politician, Barack Obama, Joe Biden, George Bush, Beyonce. They all say the same thing. How was that? And so I started to see that there's this common thread in our humanity where everybody wants to know, how was that? Did I do okay? Did you hear me? And did what I say mean something to you? So I would have to say that recognizing that in other people has helped me to become, you know, a person of compassion, a person of understanding, a person who can interview anybody about anything, because I know that it's the core of you is the same as the core of me. You just want to be heard.